has been an awakening. Have you felt it?
Light it up.
Punch it.
Welcome to Unmistakably Star Wars, your source for a high-quality, informative, and entertaining look into the Star Wars galaxy. So strap yourself in, because here's where the fun begins.
Hey, welcome to Unmistakably Star Wars, Tauntauns, and we are excited because tonight we are pushing off from the docks. The shuttle is out of the bay, and we are going to start talking about Joseph Campbell and the Hero with a Thousand Faces. Of course, you and I, dear Star Wars fans, we know that Joseph Campbell was a pinnacle part of the Star Wars journey and the Star Wars saga when Lucas was pounding out the initial scripts to the original film back in 1975 and 1976. And I thought to start this series, we needed to sit down with someone that was much better versed at discussing Joseph Campbell than just a lowly old podcast host. So I went through the magic of Rolodex. For those of you that are in our younger demographic, you'll have to look up what a Rolodex is. And I came across good friend Chris Reno, who is not only former English pro, but dear listeners, he now owns his very own tap house. So, Chris, welcome to Unmistakably Star Wars.
Mr. Claffer, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
That was so formal.
Mr. Claffer. I just wanted you to feel at home.
I appreciate that. Indeed, since we're in my home, I do often require wife and children to refer to me as Mr. Claffer. So I thank you that we've got some congruency here.
Nice. Well, yeah. I require the term, my lord. Kid you not, one of my daughters calls me master, like, jokingly. She's so funny. She's 5 years old, little Lucia Jane, yes, named after Jane Austen.
Love it.
Yeah, she calls me my lord. So funny. Or my
I
master.
Love it. Yes. Anyway. So listen, before we jump into this, let's paint a little bit of background. You and I, we've got wow, this is going to sound really kind of awkward for a family-friendly podcast, but we've got a history together. We used to teach together at the same school. I was over there in the history department. You were in the English department. And then at some point, you had the brilliant idea of launching out of that place and opening up your own tap house. But when I first talked to you about this, you've actually got a little bit of insight into the writings of Joseph Campbell.
Yeah, I do. In fact, I looked for them the other day, and they were nowhere to be found. I did a master's program in humanities. I like to say huge manatees.
Yes.
Humanities, emphasis in literature. And I did an archetypal criticism course. Kind of started off with Joseph Campbell, delved into Northrop Frye and Company. It was kind of like the literary counterpoint, I guess, of Joseph Campbell. But I did a whole section on him. I had to read the whole conversation between Joseph Campbell and Bill Moyers. It's like this classic 1980s text,
yes.
You know, big coffee table, the book that probably so many people used for their worship services, kind of lapsed Catholic worship services. But I had to read that whole thing. And when it all boils down to it, I learned at the end that you just got to follow your bliss. You know, that's
there you go.
That's Joseph in a nutshell.
In your case was opening your own tap house.
Yeah, and whether or not it's bliss, that's to be debated, but I am really thankful. I am thankful. In fact, it's been awesome. We've been the proud hosts of two Unmistakably Star Wars podcast episodes.
Yeah.
I do have to say, if I were a single guy, with not a wife and family of eight, I've six children. I would be down there all the time, hanging out, podcasting, doing all kinds of casting. My one lamentation is not being able to stay there for the whole thing. So I have many children to put to bed.
Yes, indeed, indeed. Well, and I will say the times that we've been down there to do recording, I mean, both have been a blast, but this most recent time, I think it was it early December, and the local university had just, I think it was in the middle of finals week because we came down midweek. So I think most of the students were either just getting done or trying to get through the week. And, you know, when you get stressed out, inebriated college students to spill their love for Star Wars, I mean, that's just like podcast gold right there.
Yeah, I'm glad there were plenty of fans hanging out. I think you guys had an underage person.
We were
a family friendly place. Yeah. There was the young son of a college prof. I think he's a soc prof up there. Yeah. But they come in all the time. They're fantastic patrons. And they bring their little boy in. He's just a sweet kid, but he's a little firecracker, huh?
He did great. We did some trivia with him. I know that he walked away with some books and stuff. So he knows his stuff. It was good. Yeah. It was good.
That's pretty fun. Fun stuff, man. Well, hey, you know what? Even more ironic though, is that we have been trying to do this for, I don't know how many, a couple months now, several months. And
yes.
we live, what, like a 5-minute walk from each other?
Yeah. I mean, by the way, the crow flies, I'm probably guessing about 400 yards or so.
Yeah. Yeah. I could almost probably throw a rock, you know, to your house and a number of shots, but you guys are right up the road, man. Right towards the unfortunately named park. I love it. I love it. So.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Yes, it is.
So listen, I want to tell you this as we get going on this, that as I was kind of lining up some folks to be part of this series, we've got some good friends that are Star Wars authors and have written some books that folks would be familiar with. And as I was engaging with one of them about coming on to do part of the series, it was this confession, and I don't want to out him. Maybe he'll do that himself when he's on, but he said, you know, and here's an official Star Wars author that's written books that the majority of Star Wars fandom has probably read at one time or another. And he said he's actually never read Joseph Campbell. And I was shocked. I didn't even know that was allowed. I was absolutely shocked.
Yeah. He's the theologian, right? He's the priest, you know, the non-priest priest behind, you know, Star Wars.
Yes. He is. So let's talk a little bit about Joseph Campbell. You know, he's got this, what he refers to as the hero's journey. And I don't know, there's 16 or 17 different points to it. And it's this progression of feeling the call, being called, pursuing the call, yada, yada, yada. We go on this journey. We meet some people. We've got a wise sage. And ultimately, we have these trials and tribulations. And then it climaxes at the end there with what makes that person the hero.
So, after a death and resurrection and
let's not forget about the death and
all the points, all the words in there.
Yes. Let's start with this though. As you mentioned, Joseph Campbell, by all accounts, is the godfather of Star Wars mythology in many ways. And so, what is it about Campbell's works, in your opinion, Chris, that have really, I guess, not only stood the test of time, but have really kind of nailed down something where the vast majority of humans that I know feel like they either are called in moments or they want to identify with heroes, if not as a hero. What is it about his works that really kind of push into our own human hearts?
I think, I'm gonna come straight at this. Full disclosure, I am a full-on Trinitarian Christian.
Okay. And
so I would give an answer kind of like J.R.R. Tolkien actually gave Lewis before Lewis converted to Christianity. Am I getting off track here?
No, but what I want to do for our listeners who may not be familiar with what a Trinitarian Christian is, kind of unpack that for us.
So the Trinity is falling on hard times these days. It's difficult to comprehend, you know, like you've got Father, Son, Holy Ghost. That's the name that God has revealed himself to have, you know, at the Great Commission, the end of Matthew, you know, go into all the world. All power and authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. And baptize in the name, singular name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And you have like Trinitarian kind of theology packed right in there, kind of okay. in Jesus's last words, you know, before, according to Joseph Campbell, he ascended into the disciples' hearts.
So there's some difference in opinion on how that translates, but sure.
Big time. So basically, I bring that out to say, I think the reason that, and I know you asked about people identifying, but I think the reason people identify is because, you know, a lot of these world religions do have kind of this shape, kind of mm-hmm. this redemptive shape to them. Mm-hmm. So I think there is something, you know, like fundamentally in us. And I think Carl Jung is another name. He is he was kind of a contemporary with Freud, and they had their big, you know, falling out. Carl Jung was kind of the originator of like kind of the archetype, like kind of the philosophical archetypes of all these different cultures sharing kind of similar kind of shaped stories.
Right.
You know, around how in the world do all of these cultures like share these common themes and these common shapes to story, mm-hmm. To where we identify when we read something, we identify with this. And his answer, it's slipping my mind right now. Basically like, there was a subconscious, you know, kind of the subconsciousness that kind of envelops the earth. Mm-hmm. As a Christian, I would say the reason, is because we're created by, you know, common God. And these stories come down to us, you know, via our ancestors. And that this is the way that God has created the world. And it's most poignantly revealed in, you know, the Old and New Testaments. But I think that's the reason that people identify with it. And the answer that Tolkien gave Lewis, you know, like why all these things have the similar shape is that, you know, they all share a similar shape. Because there's actually a God, you know, has revealed himself and has stepped in to the story. Mm-hmm. And it's the myth that has become fact. It's the myth mm-hmm. that actually has manifested itself in history. So that's my take on why I think people identify with this, because we are made in God's image. And we share that commonality. We can't get away from it. Mm. And, you know, those of us who tend to deny that, we can't help but borrow from that. We will reflect God in some way. I don't know if you're planning on going that route, but
No, I love that. The only route that I plan to go in is toss questions to you and see where you take the conversation. So I'm totally comfortable with that. I'm curious though, because the tail end of that, you did mention like in terms of, especially here, not only in the West, but especially in the town that we live in, Santa Cruz, California, it is a virtual spiritual buffet where we have people not only maybe worshiping traditionally with Christian beliefs or Buddhist beliefs or Hindu beliefs, but also we have a very kind of syncretist society where it's like, oh, I like a little bit of Jesus. I like a little bit of Buddha. And I'm just going to kind of maybe take this rock and crystal and I love the redwoods and it's my own religion.
Totally. So
where does that kind of parallel to where Campbell takes us when it comes to, you mentioned the word archetype, where along this hero's journey do we see some of these things that draw us to a creator? And whatever you want to label that creator, fine, but to a creator and to the situations where we have an opportunity to go on this journey, to rise above, you mentioned before, to have a death and to become resurrected, whether spiritually, emotionally, physically, whatever.
Ooh, that was a lot.
I know. I'm terrible at that. Let's unpack it at your leisure, though.
Good preaching, Pastor. can you boil the question down a little bit more?
Yeah.
Boil a little more meat off the bone.
Let me distill it a little bit for you.
I like that term.
I thought you might. So we recognize that there is a creator and that different people recognize that there is a creator or a divine force or the unseen, right? Regardless of how persons may label that with their own individual faith or spiritual beliefs.
Yes.
But what I'm hearing transcends or at least plays nicely with that is that we all either want to partake on this hero's journey, regardless of our own beliefs of creation, redemption, all that stuff, and or the hero's journey is also alluring to us because when we see other people on it, it sometimes gives us hope that we could also rise above and achieve what that person is achieving. Is that fair to say?
I mean, it's just insofar as identifying with it, where it resonates with everybody.
Right.
Yes. And it would go back to, the way that just, there is just something inherent in the shape of story. In fact, I think Joseph Campbell, maybe I'm going off here, but Joseph Campbell was a lapsed Catholic. I mean, he grew up Catholic. He grew up, you know, knowing the liturgy, studying Catholic, theology. And what he did, was essentially what a lot of the, late, 19th century, kind of mythologists, mythologizers, people who were like, as America and England were getting more secularized, they retained kind of the skeletal structure of theology, but really kind of stripped the meat off the bones, I guess, if you will. So they retained kind of the classic structure of the Christian story, pulled that off, and then kind of saw that, hey, other religions kind of share the same story. They have the same shape. And it probably, kind of dovetails with evolutionary theory and all that, kind of common kind of like, religious, ancestry. But the fact that we do share, that we do like identify with these stories, I mean, it is powerful. Like you can pretty much like boil like every Disney, film down to like the hero's journey. Right.
Right. Right.
But I guess the question is how far down do we want to boil it? You know what I mean? Do we really want to boil everything down to where you do get Joseph Campbell theology and you are left with follow your bliss? Because that is kind of a dangerous proposal.
Say more about that. Why do you think that?
And honestly, like follow your bliss. It's a sentence. And I don't know. It is dangerous in the sense that bliss, and we're seeing this, in our culture today, bliss for different people can mean so many things, to the point of like, damaging things as well. We're seeing people like following bliss, into a number of different, kind of cultural expressions or personal expressions of like what my bliss means to me, and then regretting it, down the line. And so I think, to boil his ethic down, which he says is his own ethic, follow your heart. I mean, my kid, we watch these, Disney films, and my kids can spot it, like right and left, like, oh, follow your heart. Dad, that's not right. And it's like, the heart, is pretty easily deceived. I mean, any of us who like reflect on ourselves, like for more than a second or two, know how deceptive we suckers are.
Yeah.
But anyway, it is a dangerous ethic, because then it's really kind of a war of kind of all against everybody.
Well, it's interesting in many ways. And I think one of the ways that strikes me right now in our conversation is that there's something, I almost said anti-hero, but that wouldn't be the correct phrase, but contrary to what a hero does, whereas a hero very, very often is not out for his or her own bliss per se, but is seeking to either find redemption for having followed bliss and it's cost whatever type of peril, or trying to do something that is bigger than the individual. So when it comes to that within, can we call it, is it Campbellian theology? Can we go there?
Yeah, for sure.
When we look at Campbell and as he describes that archetype and the journey that takes place over the course of this person's life, or perhaps more than just once, depending on who it is and their circumstances, what do you think, Chris, when it comes to, I'm seeing that portrayed on the screen, and therefore I identify with, I want to be like, and then fill in whatever, Luke Skywalker, Han Solo, Princess Leia. What is it when we see that on this on the screen that makes us say like, oh my gosh, I want to be like that?
I'll tell you a little anecdote. I mean, and here is here's kind of like a playground. Follow your bliss. Are you with me here?
So go.
I'll tell you when I was born in 75, and we had all just like Star Wars, New Hope in our bottles. I think our moms had imbibed it, so we were getting it suppressed. But I remember, it was probably like 1979. I was like 1980, maybe 4 or 5. And I was with a few of my buddies, and we were like, dude, we were doing Star Wars. Like, we were going to act this out. We were going to follow our bliss, and we were figuring out who was going to play who.
Yeah.
And who was going to play whom. Anyway, I was like, I'm going to be Han Solo. I just dug Han Solo, like,
yeah,
from a young age. And my buddy, Jesse Greer, got really, really angry at me. He's like, I'm playing Han Solo.
Nice. And
I'm playing Han Solo. And he picks up a rock and he chucks it right at my head.
Wow.
I duck, and it hit my friend Jonathan Wright square in the forehead. And man, it was just a massacre. It was a bloody massacre.
Oh my gosh.
It was this little moment of like kind of just trying to follow our bliss, like even just being the characters, and it ended up with a slaughter.
That's awesome.
But it is good. It is good to look. We are like, we are mimetic creatures. Like we mimic, mm-hmm. And I think there is something there. When we identify with somebody and say, I want to be like that. The danger, is if we're not, kind of called, to a particular calling, is forcing that. Like, no, right. I am going to do this, We would call those people crazy, who identify as a particular, person, or eventually like believe that they are that person.
Right.
I think there's a certain type of inescapability, to mimetic or, imitation. That's what mimetic is imitation. You remember being like a little kid and like imitating your dad or putting your shoes just like he had his,
right
next to his. And, we can't get away from that. We even mimic our enemies, and desires. And there's quite a bit that's been written, by Rene Girard on that. And I think he's onto something, there. It's kind of another theorist, but, I think it is good to mimic, the right people, in the right way for the right reasons. And I think, reasons are a big part of that. I'm trying to think of on Star Wars. I mean, can you think of Luke kind of doing anything for his own glory? I think there are moments when he's like young, he's like, I want to take off. I want to do this. And, kind of beat his chest and grow up a little bit, which is those good things, the desire to grow and kind of break out of kind of his little kind of provincial life, that he had going on. Bell-esque existence.
It's an interesting question, right? Because I think that, we see him, especially in Star Wars, The New Hope, and then in Empire, like he flat out leaves his training to go help his friends. So I get like, in some ways that's selfish because he's, potentially giving up on the greater good. But I think that the majority of us, myself included, when we saw that as kids, we're just like, of course I'm going to make sure that my friends are okay.
Right.
And then, I mean, we could probably go as far as even looking at Return of the Jedi when he wants to go and meet Vader face to face and basically surrenders himself on the forest moon of Endor. Is he doing that to bring restoration and redemption to his father, or is he doing that for the greater good of the universe? And perhaps both.
Yeah, I would say both.
Yeah.
I think
that's what I want to say, right?
Yeah. Well, that's what happens, right?
Yeah.
I think he sees I think he sees both of those as inextricable, and that's why he doesn't deviate from that. And that's, you know, I think he massively matures, you know, throughout those are the three that I would talk about. Those are my episodes right there.
Yeah.
But, you know, all the way from like Tashi Station, you know, and power converters, you know, all the way to, you know, father, yes. You know, acknowledging who his dark father is. Right. And right. Saying, you know, I know, he says, I know there's good in you. And that's kind of the whole kind of like force kind of theology, but he does. I mean, Darth Vader repents, you know, not dust and ashes, but definitely in some serious electric, you know, light show, you know?
Yeah. Yes. And I think that, you know, we could probably carry looking at Luke's actions, you know, judging him, whether they were selfish or they were for the greater good. And I know that this is probably a point of contention for some folks, but we look at episode 7 and 8, where he has isolated himself on this island. And again, I think we can argue one way is just as probably fair game as the other, as far as saying, oh, he did that selfishly because of this reason, or no, it was for the greater good because of this reason, perhaps a little bit of both. As someone once said, I believe that only Siths deal in absolute. So I'm hesitant to say it's one or the other in that. Chris, go back. I don't know about you, but for me, I remember my psychology 101 class in college. And one of the first things that we talked about was why people go to see movies. And I don't remember all the reasons, but I do remember two reasons. And one was for escapism. The other was for coping strategies. We find ourselves in a really wacky point on the timeline of history right now. As we're recording this, the majority of first world countries are under quarantine, especially us here in the United States. I know some of the states are still kind of playing loosey-goosey with it, but where we're at right now, the governor has essentially shut the state down. How important, in your opinion, is it for us to have an example of the hero's journey that we can use for coping strategies right now?
That's a good question. It's interesting, 'cause as a former English teacher, you know, someone who is reading all the time, I was nonstop reading all the time, you know, for better or for worse. It was a delight to get to read, you know, Pride and Prejudice again.
Yeah.
You know, but then you had to pick up a stack of like 25 student essays and, trying to find a diamond in the rough. There's a lot of rough.
Yes.
But, it's cool. But the reason I bring that up is just reading. I'm kind of feel sorry. I keep taking your questions and kind of spinning them a little bit.
No, that's great.
But, to answer, yes, it's important, I think, to kind of get out of ourselves so that we can more, you know, better become ourselves. But part of that is film. But I think also part of that is kind of relearning how to read. I noticed that, like, I didn't have a cell phone forever when I was a teacher for like 10 years. And my students used to be like, how do you even like live? I'm like, are we still here? Are we still here? Am I still here? I'm just fine. Thanks. And, yes. You know, how do you call your family? I'm like, see that big block thing on the wall? It's called the telephone. I use it. And when that's not working, I stand out on the stairwell and I call across the yard. my family, we were that close. But, it's interesting because when I left Monta Vista, and kind of picked up a transition job, I was required to use a smartphone. And there's a sense in which smartphones kind of make us dumber. And you've heard people say that before. I have seriously, it's been about 5 years now. I mean, we're about 4 years into the tap room almost. And it was about 5 years since I left. So half a decade, I've had a smartphone the whole time. I literally have to fight myself to put it down.
Wow.
And to read something in a sustained manner.
Yeah.
Because I think the soundbite thing, I mean, approaching things, you know, with visual, like not visual imagery, but like literally like video images,
right,
as opposed to like visual imagery in a book.
Right.
Like it's a very passive thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I find, and maybe this is just kind of something that coincides with age. I hope not, but, I think it's coincided with my use of my smartphone. It's like, I literally have to wage war mm-hmm. on myself to put the freaking thing down and pick up, you know, this thing that's called a book that has pages, like a book, not an ebook.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Book. Right. And sit there and work through it and, you know, submit myself to a sustained argument. I find myself being challenged to sit sustained argument. Let me bring this up. It says my internet connection's unstable. See, that's my point, right? The instability of technology.
Yeah.
But we used to read Beowulf, right? We read the whole thing together as a class. And we listened to Seamus Heaney's, you know, Heaney Wolf version of Beowulf. It was great, wonderful. He does a masterful job of reading his own, you know, translation. And I would do a project and I would say, all right, here's the deal. I want you guys to do an art project. Mm-hmm. And so what I did was I had a description. I pulled about five or six different translations of, mm-hmm. you know, the Old English. And I put them on my blog and I said, you can read these. Do not Google any images, you know, for the kids who did, for better, for worse, you know, that was on them.
Yeah.
But I said, read this description. It's a description of Grendel's arm when, after Beowulf has ripped it off and he's nailed it to the top of the mead hall eaves.
Mm-hmm.
And in the you get a number of different versions of it, you know, literarily. And I said, I want you to do an artistic rendering of it.
Hmm.
And they all did. And I don't know how many kids I had, 130 or whatever. And I had 130 just vastly different art projects.
Yeah, I believe it.
They all read the same thing. And I said, if we had watched the movie and I said, hey, draw a picture of this, you guys would have all drawn the same thing. I mean, there would have been different variations on that very similar image.
Right.
But it got their imaginations moving in a way that I think film kind of subverts or causes our minds to atrophy. And I'm not anti-film. I'm not anti-film.
Yeah.
I think time and place for it. I love film. I'm watch too much probably, but I think you know, hero's journey, you know, through film should be in conjunction with kind of hero's journey you know, on a literary level, just to keep our minds sharp. It's kind of like Jedi training, right? Yeah. I would say the more you watch, you know, you're kind of, there's a more of a passivity, you know, when we're being fed, you know,
right.
What our imaginations are supposed to produce. So I kind of went in a weird direction with this and I apologize, but
no, I'm with you on that. And I think that actually plays nicely with where I was kind of hoping to take things. And that is, you know, from a, to quote Obi-Wan, a certain point of view, I think that it's fair to say that when, whether through novel form or visual form, you know, one of the interesting things that Star Wars has done for so many generations. I mean, those of us that grew up in the 70s and you know, my son was about my age when I was five for the original. He was around the same age when the prequels came out. And my daughter is about that age when the sequels came out. Yes, folks, there's a gap in there. But what's cool, though, is even though traditionally Star Wars fans would see things on screen, I think for me in particular, it led to so many creative, imaginative play things. Whether that was just, as you mentioned at the very get-go, on the playground with your buddies, or with the proverbial merchandise that came out of every form in the 70s through now when it comes to the action figures and the ships and all that stuff. But I think that that's one of the things that pairs so nicely when we look at Star Wars and Campbell, and whether it's coping strategies or just the desire to be a hero, is meaning Star Wars, has given us this opportunity to not only see the hero's journey in various forms, but on a playground level, experience it. And then I guess the next question is, Chris, when it comes to a hero, right? We probably don't have too many people around now that are going to have a chance single-handedly to save the galaxy. At least I hope not. but we do have other folks that it would be proper to use the label hero to describe them. And we don't even need to use like military or first responders, because I think those are natural fits. But
yeah,
when you look at the label hero and looking in our 21st century context, how do we apply that term to our 21st century lives today, if we're not in the military or, you know, a first responder?
Well, man, I think, gosh, there is a sense in which there have been so many people who have destroyed their families because they're trying to be heroes.
Wow.
In the wrong way. Mm. And as a father, you know, with six kids, I look around and it is the way I can be a hero. Mm. Sometimes is as mundane as getting up in the middle of the night and taking care of my screaming infant, you know, instead of having my wife do it. That is like, and I have failed more, you know, I failed a number of times because I'm literally unconscious. Like, I had no idea. I'm so sorry. You should have woken me up kind of moments. But man, it is, I would say that the call, I think, especially for, you know, married men and men with children, is for us to be faithful.
Mm.
That sounds pedestrian. It certainly doesn't involve, like, you know, kind of the mystique of lightsabers. But that's a very being faithful. To the end, being faithful to our wives and faithful to our children is probably one of the, as a man, is one of the most important callings that I have. And I think I imagine you would agree with that. I'm thinking, and then you've got, you know, a handful of people. You know, the other day we showed a few of our older kids Amazing Grace. It's the story of William Wilberforce and the slave trade.
Okay.
Man, what that man endured, you know, just on a physical level, you know, with his colitis and continuing to push forth, you know, forward with his desire to abolish the slave trade, and, you know, working in tandem with a number of other, you know, historical characters like Equiano and, you know, William Pitt. A lot of these characters are, heroes, you know, in a kind of a larger cultural sense.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, especially like when you're making a movie, I imagine, you know, I haven't read any, you know, biographies on Wilberforce. You know, my exposure to him is primarily the movie and just some things that I've heard, you know, about him and some lectures, but, I imagine we could take a look at his life, or at least the movie, and kind of delineate a hero's journey, through that, you know, as well. I mean, he would be an example. Actually one that's a little bit closer to home. I have a band, or at least I had a band that existed, you know, for a couple of days. We did some, it's existed for a long time. We never got to play very often, like live. And literally our sound checks, you know, would be our practice, you know, before we do a show, because people would be flying in. But we have our violinist, Alex Wormbrand. He is the grandson of a very famous Romanian pastor named Richard Wormbrand, who was a, have you heard of him?
No, actually I haven't.
Have you heard of Voice of the Martyrs? Have you heard of that?
Yes, yes.
So basically it's a I don't know what it is, a group or a ministry that was started by Richard and his wife Sabina Wormbrand. I think it was during the 60s, during the communist takeover in Romania. But he suffered imprisonings and beatings. I think Prime has a brand new movie on him right now.
Wow. Okay.
Just came out that I want to watch, but that guy's a hero in my mind. We have a song called Freedom that my buddy Jordan wrote after he read Richard Wormbrand's book called Tortured for Christ, but it was in solitary confinement. He got the life beat out of him and then continued to minister even to like communist, you know, prison guards.
Wow.
And tons of them got converted as a result of it. But it's like you read accounts like that and you're like, man, I mean, there are times in history where, where the call to be a hero in that respect, is upon us. I don't desire that. Like, but I guess here, one of the important lessons I've learned is that, you know, we're not going to be a hero in the big things if we're not a hero in the small things. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I guess practice being a hero, by getting off your butt and doing the dishes or, you know, blessing somebody with something, that you don't have to do and that you probably don't want to do. And it's not glorious. You know, no one's going to give you props for it.
Right. Right.
But anyway, there's a number of different ways to be a hero and all the little ways, you know, there's little ways every day that we can practice being a hero. So anyway, I don't know if that starts to answer your question or what, but.
No, I love that. And I think that's a great perspective to have given where we're at. I know with so many social constructs that we have today, hero, like so many things, can be so watered down that we're all heroes, right? Maybe, but probably not. But I don't think that we all have to rise to
this. Hero of avoiding responsibilities.
yes. Superhero power, procrastination.
That's right.
Exactly. But I think that you're right, though, that there is some beauty and perhaps heroism in doing the things that need to be done, even though we may not want to do them. And you use the example of being a parent. I think that that's a fantastic one. And there are so many other ones that are so similar to that, that I think that can sometimes get overlooked. And in fact, it's interesting that being a history nerd, and for as many men and women that I've spoke to over the years that have served in combat, every single one of them, from quite literally the Battle of the Bulge in World War II to the Vietnam War to Operation Desert Storm in 1991, they would all categorically reject the label of hero.
Yeah.
And it's a fascinating, it's this weird dance that we do with this label of hero, and those that probably deserve the title from our common definitions and common understandings are very likely the ones that want nothing to do with that title.
Yeah. That may be one of the characteristics of being a true hero.
Really?
Is, you know, not grasping after heroism. I mean, I taught classical lit, you know, at Monta Vista and, you know, you saw, man, there was so much bravado in classical heroism, you know, so much chest beating. Yeah. You know, this is so-and-so's sword, you know, I killed him and I stole it on the field of battle.
Right.
The meme monster, Brian Reagan.
Yes.
and it's you look at that kind of stuff, and yeah, there's a sense in which they're heroic, you know, there's a sense in which Achilles is heroic, but man, right. If that guy is not a, you know, a big grown up, you know, overgrown baby in diapers, you know, I don't know what else or who else is. Cause he is, yeah. He is like, he's just pouting, you know, he's yeah. had his like little, you know, war bride concubine stolen from him by, you know, was it not Menelaus, Agamemnon in the Iliad. And he's over in his playpen pouting, about, you know, someone stole his like, you know, pretty toy, you know, right. this pretty boy over right. there. And right. I'm not going to fight. I've been, you know, like dissed. And, you're like, wow, is that guy really a hero? You know? And I think you find out that no, in fact, he's not really, you know, kind of the quintessential hero in the Iliad. You know who is, though, more of a hero is Hector, whose little brother was just a little putz and swipe Menelaus's wife, you know. Yeah. And you see he's way more of a hero than Achilles is. He's a family man. He's like, you know, you see that he's loyal to his wife. You see a tender moment where he's holding his, you know, child up, you know, yeah. and the guy who he gets bested by Achilles, yeah. but, you know, you say, you know what, who is the better man? You know,
right. Right.
Hector's the better man.
Yeah.
And you see an image of kind of familial tenderness there that you don't see with Achilles. You just see a
right.
Well, outing like little high school senior.
Totally. Totally. And I think that, you know, we look at that example and bring it back to the 21st century. And I think that, you know, we do equally of a horrible job tacking in the opposite direction, saying that, oh, that this sports figure or this musician or this film star, they're heroes. And, you know, some of them have no doubt give back to their communities and all that stuff. But I don't know that just rising to the pinnacle of stardom with whatever you happen to be gifted with is necessarily makes you out to be a hero.
Yeah.
Chris, let me ask you this, because you brought this up earlier, and one of the things that it brought up is we're also in this period right now where, and Star Wars is a fantastic example where we've seen it grow from, even with the prequels, but especially now with the sequels and some of the animated series, we've saw a rise in not only the portrayal, but the acceptance and even more clamoring for the female hero, the heroine. And I know that you at one point taught an intensive course on Jane Austen, I believe. I think it was during what we call like Jan term or March term, whenever it was. And so do you think that the heroine's journey is any different from what we would look at from all the examples we've talked about tonight from mythology that have typically been male examples?
Well, I mean, just to take a fairly well-known example of that, I would say no, in the sense that, you know, you have someone, you know, like Lizzie Bennet, you know, from Pride and Prejudice. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you know, she's not the man, right? But she's very strong. I think our culture tends to like try and conflate male and female. It drives me crazy because we are made male and female. Yeah. And we're supposed to be a hero in our maleness and a hero in our femaleness, you know, whichever you are, and pursue it that way. You know, Lizzie, she knows she's a woman, but she is a strong character. She's got her, you know, she's got her her weaknesses, her sins. But she, man, I can tell you what, they are. And I talk to my kids about this sometimes, is like, you're really good at this, or you're really gifted with words. This is like one of your strengths. But hey, on the other side of that coin is the weakness that accompanies it. You know, she is so insightful. And she is her ability to communicate and kind of, you know, confront, you know, injustice in her society is fantastic, but she also gets it horribly wrong sometimes, and she realizes it. But I think one of the one of the important things as a hero is like knowing when, you know, she recognizes when she has like, oh man, I was wrong. You know, I overstepped this line. And so does Darcy, you know, Darcy realizes that, but she is a fantastic hero who goes through her own, you know, hero's journey. And she ends up the wife of a man who she ends up marrying for both of the reasons. Actually, the fundamental reason that she wants to get married is for love. She's like, I do not want to get married unless it's for love. And she had the opportunity to marry him, but she basically would have been no better than just kind of his hunting dog, you know, kind of doing his bidding. She said no to him. She stands up. She's like, you have just offended me. You've just like, you know, kind of desecrated my family. Told me that you liked me against your will.
Right.
See you later, sucka.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And man, he just gets, he deserves a response like that. But he also repents too. You know, and he owns up for it. And it's really tender, you know, to the end, towards the end, they're both confessing their own downfalls, you know, to each other, but there's massive forgiveness there, but they're doing it as, you know, male and female, characters. But, yeah, I think Lizzie Bennett is a fantastic one. Kind of hero's journey. I'm trying to think of, maybe it's not such a good fit. I'm trying to think of who would be like the wise sage. You know what? There is a wise sage character. I think it's her aunt, Gardner.
Okay.
Is a bit of a wise sage because her mother certainly is a sad creature.
I was going to say, does not fit that bill.
Not at all. But anyway, yeah. So I don't know. Does that kind of answer?
Yeah, absolutely. No, well said. I really, really like how you unpacked that. That was good. Hey, it was good to hang out with you.
We talked so much Joseph Campbell, man.
But no, listen, everything that we talked about is totally like in parallel with what he brings out within the hero's journey. And I think that that's really, especially as, you know, the first episode of the series, I think that that's what's so great about it is we realize that we can shout Joseph Campbell and Star Wars all day long, but when we really take a look at it, we understand that the things that Campbell talks about, we can see going on around us and maybe different shades of it because of the difference in time and society and culture and all that stuff. But I think that we see shades of it in our daily lives when we are observant enough to take
hold. I think one thing in closing, it is, and this is the challenge, is kind of in our modern postmodern age. Mm-hmm. We all want to be the hero, but we also all want to think that we're the author. And that can be a major flaw. That's like kind of starting your story the wrong way, where you're like, I'm the author of my own story. Like, whoo, you know, every story I ever wrote or I ever read, you know, I'm pretty sure there's an author behind it, who is not the main character. Sometimes there is, you know, kind of some coincidence there.
Right.
But I think it's important, as we go about our lives. And I have to ask myself this sometimes is like, okay, I think I'm being this character, but am I really being a new character? Right.
Right.
You know, am I, you know, a reformed Darcy, or am I acting like a George Wickham or a George Wickham? And it really, I mean, it's an important question to ask.
Yeah.
It's easy to say, oh, I want to be this character. It's not quite so easy actually to be that character.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Oh, you know, it totally does. And I think, you know, in addition to that, when we try to finagle our very real lives into works of fictional characters, that's a slippery slope on any good day. But then I think we also come to a point where, you know, there are perfectly evil people within fiction, but they don't see themselves as evil. And so I think it's another example of like, be careful. You going back to like writing your own story, be careful of the perspective you think that you have, because on the other side of that coin, it may be quite the opposite from those that are having to deal with the ramifications of your decisions or attitudes or actions or whatever else.
Right. I mean, it's kind of goes hand in hand with like all those, you know, itinerant preachers who like left their families, you know, to go save the world and then just destroy their own families, you know. Flannery O'Connor deals with that, you know, and Parker's Back. That's a, you know,
that's all right.
She nails that. That was a pretty common thing in the South. And I'm thinking another instance, you know, where you have someone who's like moved, you know, to like almost kind of this joyous kind of rapture is I think it was really poignant that Peter Jackson included this image in, I think it was that Two Towers. But anyway, Wormtongue, you know, Grima Wormtongue is with, Saruman up, you know, at the top, and they're looking out over the, you know, the orc multitudes, and you just see a tear roll down his eye when he's overcome with the power, you know, of Mordor. And you're like, wow, even bad guys can cry, you know,
totally
evil guys, you know, who are like, just because you have emotion and you're crying about it doesn't mean that it's a glorious thing.
Totally.
So it's kind of like what you were talking about right there. I just, that image came to mind. And yes, the image came from a movie.
You're such a hypocrite. Well, Chris, thanks for hanging out with us tonight, man. We will do it again. If not you coming on via a satellite from two blocks away, then we'll obviously have to come down and do another live broadcast down at Poor Tap Room in Santa Cruz.
Oh, dude, I would love to have you down, and I'd love to hoist a pint with you.
Unmistakably Star Wars is a member of the Star Wars Escape Pods Network. Explore more great content and get to know our sister shows at weareescapepods.com and on Twitter at @weareescapepods. The Star Wars Escape Pods Network, promoting positivity in fandom.
This podcast is a production of Be Heard Studios. To learn more about Be Heard Studios and its shows, as well as opportunities for those looking to begin a podcast, visit us online at BeHeardStudios.com. Be Heard Studios, creators of diverse listening experiences.